It's time for another Internet Advisor Show podcast. Since 1998, we've been helping computer users get on the Internet, get around it, and get over the problems they encounter there. The Internet Advisor is a two-hour weekly radio program heard on WJR 760 AM in Detroit since 1998 and across the state of Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network. Now, here are your hosts with this week's Internet Advisor podcast.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Hi, this is Foster Brown, the co-host of the program, along with Gary Baker, Ed Rudell, and Cal Carson in studio, and we have a great program lined up for you. 3 full hours of the Internet Advisor. For those of you who can enjoy it live, welcome. In this first hour, we got a lot of things to talk about. Everything from the news headlines with Mike Brennan to Thunder Chickens. You'll have to wait to find out what that's all about. And 2 hours of answering your questions here on the Internet Advisor. Welcome. If the rowdiness of my cohorts is any indication, this is going to be a good program. It's going to be a wild one. We've got lots of guests here in studio and on the line. And in this first hour, we're going to be digging into everything from encouraging women to become angel investors a whole lot of other stuff, including Thunder Chickens. We are going to find out what Thunder Chickens are.
I can just picture a Thunder Chicken like a superhero costume, a chicken in a superhero costume. I think that's got to be it. Man, we'll find out.
A new comic book hero. Yes. That must be it. That's Gary Baker, my co-host for many years here. Eddie Riddell, how you doing?
Always great to be here.
And Cal Carson.
Oh, my God, I'm so glad to be back. And you know something? You're just as smooth since the last time I left you.
I know, but without you, we just don't have that. Je ne sais quoi.
The guy is just like velvet. You know, you're like a pair of underwear. You just put them on, you don't even think about it.
I don't think I want to go with my grave with that image.
I wondered where that was going. Okay.
Don't.
Well, under my pants, hopefully.
Don't encourage him. Anyway, we're going to put you two guys and Gary to work with 2 hours of calls. We're going to be taking listener calls starting this next hour. We're on from 4 until 7 for those of you who can be with us for 3 hours.
Woo-hoo.
And otherwise, you can listen to the podcast and see how those other 2 hours went. In any case, guys, I want to get Mr. Mike Brennan on the line with us. Make sure he's blowing his hands and trying to keep warm out there in Ann Arbor. Mike, welcome to the program.
Well, it's 76 and sunny out here. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Oh, wait a minute. What planet are you on?
Yeah, don't you wish.
He's inside.
That's it. Where the temperature can be controlled, right?
Yeah.
Well, Mike is the editor of MI Tech News, and we've enjoyed. Matter of fact, I have to tell you folks, I have been using Mike's stories as leads for some of the things that we talk about here on our Internet Advisor program, and that's exactly kind of proof for me of the value that Mike and his headlines have. And every week he puts together on Friday a list of those headlines that talk about things that are happening around the state and the nation in terms of technology. And then also for entrepreneurs, a lot of great contacts in there as well, Mike. And you've added some audio elements and some video elements, and we'll talk about this shortly. But let's talk about some of your headlines that you have this week as kind of an example of the things that you've got printed there. For instance, I see that Michigan is ranking high in terms of best job markets. That's good news for us.
Yeah, it's a Gallup poll, but you know how Manpower surveys the employers. This was a poll of employees or people working at a company, and we came in third in the country, and something like 42% of the Michigan folks they interviewed said their companies were hiring. So a little different from Manpower, but same kind of thing.
But it's still good news. I guess from the grassroots, the people who are most concerned about having jobs, the employees, that's really good news. And I guess this kind of goes along with it. Another headline you have here is that tech employment, in particular in metropolitan Detroit, rivals major U.S. tech clusters.
Yeah, that comes from Automation Alley, which probably most of the listeners know what that is. It represents 10 counties in southeast Michigan. It's more of a marketing organization. They say that surveys done by Anderson out of Patrick Anderson out of East Lansing, the Anderson Economic Group, shows about 250,000 tech jobs in Southeast Michigan.
Wow.
Probably a lot of those are in the auto area, of course, but
right.
Certainly that rivals a lot of other tech clusters around the country.
And we've been hearing, too, Gary, we've talked with people who have come back from the coasts
mm-hmm.
in order to start business here.
That's right. Well, there's a lot of competition. It's expensive on the coast,
exactly.
It's Silicon Valley in particular. And here, we're so interested in bringing those kind of companies back. We're giving them lots of help, and they don't
Absolutely.
Get that elsewhere.
Well, you said, and Mike, you referred to it as well, the car industry has always kept us on the leading edge of technology. Because you're always making something better.
There certainly have a lot of people involved in IT in
yep.
auto tech.
Right, exactly.
And they can't find enough people to fill those jobs.
They can't.
Here in Ann Arbor, we have all these tech centers led by the Toyota Tech Center just on the edge of town. They're hiring. Everybody's hiring, and they're right. just looking for these people. So
and we're talking about also keeping the people come out of universities, too, as being
yeah,
very
absolutely.
Important.
Right. We won't talk about that. I've been doing that for years, trying to keep talent here in the state,
right.
and I can't even keep my own daughter from going to California.
She headed to California. That's right, Gary. Boomerang, she'll
yep,
be back.
Yep. But she'll be back. That's
I
right.
She'll be back.
She might. I hope so.
Another headline I saw here was that the MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, is gotten together with Connect Michigan to offer an app to find the fastest internet connections.
Yeah, I guess there's an app for everything these days, including that. So, I mean, you dial in and it'll tell you what the fastest fiber optics or broadband carriers are in particular areas, and it's really aimed at site selectors and other folks like that so they can zero in on the fastest fiber or the fastest internet connections.
Yep.
But they just announced that on Friday, so I haven't had a chance to really run down the rest of the story. So,
yep.
But it sounds very interesting.
It is fascinating. I have posted links to that interactive map, folks, on our homepage, internetadvisor.net. And if you go there and click and put in your zip code, and I have information on that, and then take a look at the broadband. It's neat. It gives you all sorts of different layers that you can show up. You know, when you go to a weather site, you can see the radar or the clouds or whatever you want. And this is kind of the same thing. You can see where fiber cable is, how close it is to you. And for those of you who are listeners, I know outside of big metropolitan areas have often asked, where is the nearest cable provider? You know, where can I get the best signal? This is a great place to start. And it'll show you right down to the city where you've got different resources. And by the way, these headlines, along with many others, are available on Fridays through mitechnews.com. Go to our homepage, internetadvisor.net, and you can simply scroll down to the page to Mike's smiling face and hit the subscribe button, and you're right there. You'll get not only these headlines, lots of great video and audio resources as well, including our podcast and IT in the D. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. Stay warm.
Yeah, I was going to say the same. I know you guys are way up in the air there in that Fisher building, so stay warm. So.
Okay. Well, Gary, you know the term angel investor is very important in the world of entrepreneurs. But let's define what an angel investor is.
Sure. So, you know, it's typically when you start a company, a lot of companies are started either with your own funds or family and friends, right?
Right.
When you go to a more of a professional investor, there are really a couple different kinds. You could go straight to venture capital, and that's really a professional investor, and they raise funds from other people,
mm-hmm.
and they invest, you know, their fund money in particular companies.
Okay.
An angel investor is somebody that has a lot of money, probably made it themselves,
mm-hmm.
and they're willing now to take and invest that, and they'll instead of investing it in just the stock market or real estate or other things, they're investing some of it to help companies get started. A lot of times that comes with expertise. They've
mm-hmm.
built one or two companies,
okay.
three companies in the past. So they'll not only put their own money in, but they'll put time and sweat
and
tears
capital.
In.
Right, exactly. That's really...
And that's really what defines an angel investor. There's somebody that comes in when you need somebody that to invest in your company and there's nobody else around. It's like an angel that comes and helps you.
Well, we have an angel on the line then. Let me introduce Monica Wheat, who is the Detroit lead for Pipeline Fellowship. Monica, welcome to the Internet Advisor.
Thank you
so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
You are our angel, I understand, because you folks with Pipeline Fellowship in particular are trying to develop an awareness, a group of women who can be these angel investors. And I guess the question is, why particularly women?
Well, I guess one of the things is as you look at how businesses are started, you don't see a lot of women in the angel investment role. Less than 20% of angel investors typically are women. Mm-hmm. And we at the Pipeline Fellowship are trying to change that. We're hoping that this added push with bringing the Pipeline Fellowship to different areas like Detroit will open up the awareness of the levels of money that it takes to be an angel and just the skill set and the confidence that it takes to be able to successfully invest in different entrepreneurial ventures.
I know there have to be women around who have the wherewithal, some very capable women in our Detroit area. We've had them on the air with us, you know, who have done very well in business.
That's right.
Is it they just haven't been aware of this, or they haven't been challenged to do this?
A little of both. Honestly, with most of venture capital or most of finance, it's a very, they call it pattern matching. And the key is that most people, a lot of the investments are made based on comfort levels. It's dependent upon, you know, you investing in someone that you feel comfortable with. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, that happens to be men, and that happens to be all white men. So the goal is that, you know, you have more angel investors that are diverse, that are women, that they will be more likely to invest in women-led companies. So it's just part of the ecosystem of building those relationships and making people more accessible.
Can you give me an example, Monica, from your experience of what some of these female angel investors would be or who they would be?
Typically, it's someone who has an interest in entrepreneurial space. But mm-hmm. for the Pipeline Fellowship specifically, we look for women who are qualified to be an accredited investor. So an accredited investor needs to have $200,000 in personal income over the last couple of years, or about $1 million of net worth. If you can meet that criteria, that's the core piece of just you have the money and the wherewithal to participate. The other two parts are they would be a woman who's really interested in the group learning model. So the Pipeline Fellowship is very small on purpose, mm-hmm. And it's led by seasoned angel investors who come in and teach the cohort about risk assessment, about market you know, market valuation, about you know, is this a good investment, how to pick them, those kind of things. And the last piece is that they, as a group, they put together their first investment as a group. It's a live, real investment in a woman-led company. So someone who's interested in all three of those phases would be the kind of key person for the Pipeline Fellowship, Detroit.
Now, I noticed that this began in the Southwest with some Latinas who were investing in their world, right?
Actually, in New York.
What's New York?
But,
okay.
Yes, 2011. Our founder, Natalia Oberti Nugura, she's based out of New York, and basically she started Pipeline Fellowship there and has spread it to over a dozen other cities across the United States. But yes, and again, on one hand, while there's less than 20% of angel investors are women, less than 5% of them are minorities. Yeah, so the goal is just to add that depth of you know, the types of people, the different perspectives, the different industries and different life paths that people have as they come into investing that makes them, as you guys are saying, able to give that expertise, mm-hmm. coming from different problems, from different perspectives. And then you're more willing to take a risk. It's all of angel investing is about risk. You're more willing to take a risk on someone who may not meet the kind of traditional traditional pattern.
Right.
So then do you work with the entrepreneur as well to try to help bring them along and work side by side with the angel investor?
Well, not particularly, but one key component of the Pipeline Fellowship program is that halfway through the program, as I said, it is an active investing. They're actively putting an investment into a woman-led enterprise. There's a pitch summit in each city, and the pitch summit brings entrepreneurs from that city, and they get to pitch and, you know, potentially get their business funded. And then mm-hmm. that becomes the business that group of Pipeline Fellowship cohort invests in. And that also, you know, strengthens the ecosystem. That's the really key part, is that not only, even if they don't particularly get chosen to be the company that they invest in, they're able to meet women who are interested in, you know, maybe potentially investing in them down the line, And that's how, you know, the ecosystem grows, is building those relationships and getting that inside track with people who are interested in helping entrepreneurs and people who are entrepreneurs.
By the way, we're talking with Monica Wheat, who is the Detroit lead for the Pipeline Fellowship. And you can go to our homepage, internetadvisor.net, and click on that word, Pipeline Fellowship. It'll take you to their website and find a bit more about it. Monica, by the way, is also the executive director of Digerati Girls Incorporated. I love that. And co-founder of City Launch and a whole lot of other stuff. So you have, you're an entrepreneur yourself, but yes, you're involved in leading this effort right now in the metropolitan Detroit area. Cal, you had a question.
Now, Monica, I have two questions, okay, actually.
Sure.
Number one, with the female angel investors, are they looking specifically for female entrepreneurs, or they go both ways?
Well, initially for the Pipeline Fellowship, the focus is a female-led company. The company that they're going to choose to invest in is going to be a female-led company. But after the program, which lasts about 6 months, and it's about one day per month where they meet and kind of go through the paces of, with the different speakers and venture capital groups that come in to work with them, after that, then they're open to invest as they see fit. They may join an existing angel investment group, which of course can have male and female-led companies. They may choose to continue to go on their own, doing a singular investment. They may choose to create their own angel investment group. All of the above have happened in past cities.
Wow.
So if I was a male that had a idea that was slanted toward female audience, I would probably have to get a female in charge of my company to actually intertwine with that particular angel investor in order to take advantage of them at this particular point in the game.
Correct. This particular phase, but definitely the connection and the building of the ecosystem is there that might be a good opportunity just outside of the focus of the program.
Now, this has been going since, was it 2011, you said?
Yes.
It started in New York, and we're at 4 years later here, 2015. Are there any particular groups in Detroit that you hope will surface and will attract the angel investors? Or are there angel investors that you're kind of, cultivating here in the Detroit area?
Well, we're hoping that, honestly, the group Pipeline Fellowship is based on women who aren't active angel investors currently. Some people do come in who want that honing of skill set, but it's meant for people who know little to nothing about angel investing, could teach them the entire gamut from a term sheet to assessing companies, market, risk, all those different pieces.
Yeah.
So, like, particular group is more women who did not know that they could, you know, be a part of this.
Yep.
and have the skill set.
And that's part of it, what you're there to help people be aware of as well. Monica Wheat, by the way, is Detroit lead for Pipeline Fellowship, trying to stir up the coals and get some of these angel investors involved. Thanks, Monica, for being with us.
Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you. And we'll be back in just a moment. Well, now it's what we've been waiting for. The moment we've been waiting for all this hour. People want to know what a thunder chicken is. And we're going to find out in this segment of the program. I'd like to welcome back to our studios here, Christina Lee. There we go. We press the button and you're on.
Good afternoon.
How you doing, Christina?
Great.
The last time you were here was when, back in December, you were here as one of the winners at the Michigan Council Women in Technology that had done a contest about websites, right?
Yep, that's true.
And so, you took first place?
Yeah.
And what was the name of your website?
It was repurposing, and it was around that theme.
Okay, repurposing. Well, I went back and I looked that up, and I believe I have a link to that here on our internetadvisor.net homepage. So that was great that you did that. And now I hear you got back in touch with me that you're involved in a code day at Wayne State University. Is that where it's happening on the campus?
Yeah.
There? Okay. Talk about code day, what that is.
So code day is a 24-hour programming marathon where high school students and college students create anything they want with technology. So it can be an app, it can be a game, it can be a website, whatever they want.
And tell us about the atmosphere there, because it's kind of a unique atmosphere at the Code Day, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's around 27 cities right now in the U.S. simultaneously also having Code Days, and we're just the one in Detroit. And there's 60 students there, and everyone's just really helping out each other, creating anything they want.
So
I'm looking at the website, and they all look pretty green to me. They have green shirts on?
I think that's Thunder Chicken.
Oh, that's Thunder Chicken.
Oh, no. That's it. Shh, don't do that yet. Don't do that yet. We're going to get to the Thunder Chicken.
Sorry.
Don't jump the gun on that question.
I'm on the wrong website.
How did they apply for or get into this?
Well,
code date?
This is a competition for beginners and advanced. So all they had to do is just buy a ticket. So this encourages beginners to actually go to the event instead of just signing up.
Okay, good. So when they get there, I could see Ed many years ago. He would have been in that. And so would Cal. I could just see you guys being in this code day.
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask this question. When you say a beginner for code day, if I buy a ticket and walk in, do I have to know anything about coding, or I could be like completely novice?
You can be a complete beginner because we have workshops there that tell you like the basics of programming and help people build whatever they want.
Now, you know, that's a good idea, you know, so that you don't have to have a threshold, that it's meant for all levels.
Yeah.
You know, not only something to walk in and you see something, but also you can learn and participate in right away.
Now, Christina, do the pros, the ones who have been there doing it a while, do they, like, allow these rookies in to their teams?
Well, a lot of the times the pros are often the ones helping out the rookie teams.
Ah. So that's neat. So they kind of get together and they mentor them. Through this experience as well. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that are likely to come out of this code day?
Well, I know one team is building a web app that plays poker over. I think they're betting some online currency on it, and then it's a mix between a web app and then you can play it on your phones too.
Okay, so they created an application that can be used anywhere, at least, and to do something like playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been involved in the code days yourself?
Well, I'm an organizer today, but I haven't been involved in the ones in the past. However, I've gone to several programming marathons. They're called hackathons.
This is 24 hours, right?
Yeah.
That's fueled by what? Mountain Dew and pizza?
Basically, yeah.
Aaron is. I should introduce the other fellow who's here with you. Aaron is sitting in studio here. Aaron Wilcock is a junior at Wayne State University, and you've been working with the robotics team. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But have you ever participated in the code day as well? Do you know the kind of atmosphere that's there?
I have not participated in any code days before. I'm an organizer for this one, as Tina is. I've attended some hackathons.
Okay. What's a hackathon like?
I mean, a hackathon is a culmination of anyone who wants to be involved in coding, either those who have already been, right, like Tina was saying about experts, and those who would just like to join and see what it's like. And yes, it's mainly fueled by Mountain Dew, caffeinated beverages, lots of food that you would not want to consume on a daily basis. Pretty much whatever it takes to get you through those 24 or 36 hours.
There's food there, so you can get that. I'm looking now at the right website and the frequently asked questions. It says, where will I sleep? If they're sleeping, they're not coding, right? So they're not probably winning. So is that what happens? I mean, they said that you could. The answer is you can sleep anywhere. Bring a sleeping bag.
This is definitely true. And from time to time, teams will fail, quote unquote, at the project because they will stay asleep too long, won't set the alarms, or just don't want to get up.
So this is time. It's bound by time as well. You have a certain period of time that you have.
Yes.
To do all this in.
Generally, by the end, they expect that once a project is completed or near the end, you register and say, we've gotten far enough that we'd like to present. And you do so at the end.
And then as what, the organizers, are you judges as well then, or do you have other people coming in and judging?
I am not a judge. I don't believe Tina is either. Most of the time, they'll pull in judges. So, for example, we'll bring in professors. I think there's an IT director who's judging at this one. And it varies from hackathon to
hackathon. Now, when is this code day going on in Detroit?
Right now.
Right now? Oh, this,
noon
at this
today to noon tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness. It's happening right now. Hey, you know, for a lot of
us. Wait a minute. I mean, this is over St. Valentine's Day, right? And does that mean that you expect people that aren't going on dates tonight to sign up? Or do you just bring your date and have them
Nothing
come too?
Nothing says I love you like a Fortran compiler.
Saying it ain't so.
You know, when people hear the word hacker or hackathon, they think of something nefarious, something evil or underhanded. But so what is a hacker to you, Aaron?
To me, it's anyone who is willing to put forth the effort to learn the new technologies and the workarounds. I mean, obviously, in conversation, most people use it to mean something a little worse than what we're trying to show here.
Yeah, but it's kind of a neutral term in the sense of, is this somebody who has the skills?
There's white hat and black hat hackers.
That's
right?
True, white hat and black hat. Now, Christina, how about for you? What is a hacker?
I guess for me, a hacker is anyone who, like Aaron said, like wants to put in the effort to create something. It doesn't even need to be programming. It can just be like anything they want.
And at the end of the day, now at the like tomorrow, was it tomorrow at
tomorrow noon?
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow noon, when everything they blow a whistle on this, people will then present what they've done that up to that point.
Yeah, so they would give we call them pitches, and they would just say like a brief introduction about what they've done, what they learned, like what their final product is, mm-hmm. whatever.
Tina, by the way, we should just say, Christina, you are a, what year are you in high school now?
I'm a junior in high school.
You're a junior in high school, but you were in a very special kind of a setup. You should tell people about that. You're in half of your day, or half of the time, you're at?
Half of the time in the afternoon, I'm at the Utica Center for Math, Science, and Technology. And it's a magnet school, and that's where we take our STEM class, our science, technology, engineering, and math classes.
Cool.
And then for the morning, I go to Stevenson High School.
Okay.
And I would just take my liberal art classes there.
Right, right. Isn't that a neat atmosphere?
Yeah. Oh, it is. And it doesn't take much for kids in the high school or middle school to start participating in something like that. My son was also involved in STEM up in Brandon, mm-hmm. and by the time he graduated, I think he had completed 5 college courses. So he's graduating a year, if not 6 months early.
So
for that reason.
Is that
and he doesn't have to pay college courses. The schools are required to pay for it.
I see. Wow. Is that the same kind of thing that you're looking at too, Tina?
Yeah, I'm taking 3 AP classes this year just through the Math, Science, and Technology program. And then next year I'll be taking 3 more. So.
Wow.
So my big question to Tina is, where do you earn your high school letter from? Which one of the two schools?
I would earn my diploma from Stevenson.
Okay.
And which one do you care mostly about?
I don't know. I love the atmosphere at the Math, Science, Technology Center because like everyone there had to test in, so they're all really focused on trying to succeed. So they'd help each other out when they can.
Mm. Nice.
Now, you're a coder then? You know how to code, right?
Yeah, I'm a programmer.
A programmer, okay. Because you built the programming behind your site, which we have linked off to as well.
Okay, so let's have some fun then. What's the difference in a programmer and a hacker?
Well, I mean, they can be the same thing. Like a programmer. A programmer can be like just coding on the computer, but a hacker can be a programmer. It can be an engineer. It can be anyone that creates anything.
Aaron, you're going to say something. Go ahead.
Yes.
One of them you use on your resume, and the other you do not.
Oh, I like that one.
But see, it was
a
my
better definition.
Very good.
Straightforward and to the point. My thinking was a programmer is someone who creates something. A hacker is someone who de-engineer something. Would that be safe?
Well, there's white hackers, and like Gary said, there's white hat and black hat.
Aaron?
So you know what I'd like? I like this video on the site. Boy, does that show some energy.
And where's that site at, Gary?
That's we linked to it. It's codeday.org/Detroit.
And so if you go to internetadvisor.net and you go down to see Christina's smiling face there, you can just click on that Code Day Detroit and it'll take you to that website. We're going to take a quick break right now and then we're going to talk about Thunder Chickens when we come back.
That's where the green comes
You're listening
in.
To the or Internet
maybe the
Advisor.
Yellow.
Our guests are Christina Lee and Aaron Wilcock. And we'll be back in with that in just a moment as we find out, finally, what a Thunder Chicken is. All right, it's time to reveal what a Thunder Chicken is. We're talking with Christina Lee, who is a junior and involved in just kind of getting all into her coding with her website that she's developed. And all along with her is Aaron Wilcock, who is a student at Wayne State University. And where Aaron, you have been a mentor for Christina and the other folks on the Thunder Chicken team, right?
Yep. I joined in 2011 as a student on the team.
Oh.
And then after graduating and starting college, I've gone back to mentor the programming department.
So was Stevenson your home school when you were in high school?
Nope. I did take part in the same Utica Center for Math, Science, Technology program.
Oh, because it's a magnet school. I got you.
Correct.
Okay.
And the other half of my day was spent at Utica High School, which is another UCS high school.
Right. I got you. And Christina, now let's talk about Thunder Chickens. What is a Thunder Chicken? Chicken?
So Thunder Chickens is our first robotics team. And it draws a bunch of students from the Utica Community Schools District. And a lot of them come from the same MST program I'm involved in. But there's also students from other schools in the district.
Now we say FIRST Robotics is a program, and we've had Steve Heyer in here with his group.
Right.
I forget what the name of the group is.
Rush was
the name of that group.
And they won the world competition last year, right?
They won the World Chairman's Award, yep.
Yeah, exactly. So FIRST is a national, is it international as well?
It's international.
International.
That's why they won the world. See, that's
it's a contest. Thank you very much. All right.
So you guys participate with RoboFest every year as well?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Must be a different thing.
There's a number of different kind organizations.
Robotic
competitions. Mm-hmm. And FIRST, I forget what the acronym stands
for. For Innovation and Recognition of Science and Technology.
Whoa,
wow,
very
really
good.
Ding, 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 ding.
Just a junior in high school, too. You know,
so how did this name Thunder Chicken come up from robotics?
So, ironically, the Thunder Chickens were previously Team Macomb, and they had moved into the Ford Transmission Plant, their upper level that's at 18 in Van Dyke, I believe. And the name that we got was adopted from a very sarcastic variant name given to the Thunderbird after there were some modifications to the car that the engineers maybe weren't so happy about, decided to call it a Thunder Chicken, and since the team has been deemed given the same name.
Yeah, so there's no prosaic names about this. You know, the Macomb Robot Team. It's the Thunder Chickens. That's really cool. 217, I think it is. Mm-hmm. That's the other part about it. It's a Team 217 is the Thunder Chicken.
Mm-hmm,
so okay.
Yeah.
Now, you guys are preparing for a contest coming up?
We're preparing for several competitions that we're going to go to. I think we're going to one in Waterford, Bedford, Livonia, and then if we make it, we go to States.
Okay, what is your robot built to do?
So our robot every year changes based on the game that FIRST designs. This year it's called Recycle Rush, and basically it's stacking a bunch of totes and like recycling bins together to make different stacks, and for however high your stack is, then you get a certain amount of points.
So it's to get the highest stack with your robot. So you got to build this thing so it can reach higher as well. What are some of the particular challenges, Aaron, that they face in putting this thing together?
So in terms of programming alone, a lot of it is sensor fusion, just being able to take all of the different sensory inputs, proximity, using like limit switches and such, determine where the robot is located on the field, to also have it partake in autonomous features. So putting all that together in a program that's easy enough for them to understand and run.
So this is a self-driving robot?
Yes. So there are, I believe this year it's 15 seconds. At the beginning of every match or competition, there's 15 seconds where the robots are supposed to operate autonomously, so you can't use controllers or any human input.
That's got to be kind of a scary moment when you're letting these things go.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what they're teaching these young people, though, about not only robotics, but now autonomous vehicles? You should be moving right back into that plant when you graduate and help them build the autonomous vehicle.
No more Thunder Chickens.
So I want to know, what's it like to work on those robotic competitions in the chicken suit?
Working in the chicken suit obviously is a little bit warm, as you might imagine.
Do you have to wear it as the mentor?
No. Not every mentor on the team to wear the suit.
It's very cool. They should look at the website.
We will post that, yes. If you go to the post site, you can see some poor soul in the Thunder Chicken suit with the team behind him.
That's
one of the pictures on the site as well as... So and so you're working on what's your team made up of? How many guys and girls?
So there's around 50 different members on the team. I think there's exactly 48. And they're anywhere from high school sophomores to high school seniors.
Wow.
And there's mostly guys. There's I think like 20-ish girls. And then we're divided into different sections. We're divided into PR and then the robot building aspect. And then the robot building aspect is divided further to mechanical, electrical, and then programming.
What part are you in?
I'm in programming.
You're in programming. Okay. Okay, good.
It just looks like a ton of fun. I'm looking at the photographs, and it really looks like you're having fun.
But it looks like, you know, kind of organized chaos in some ways. How do you decide who's going to be in what group? Are you involved in that, Aaron?
So I think Aaron creates the organization, and Tina is really the chaos. Yeah.
So she's quiet but deadly.
Although I can't speak for all first teams, at least on ours, when we bring the students in as 10th graders, sophomores, they have the option of, you know, sort of dabbling in all of the departments.
Ah, good.
And then from there, deciding, you know, which of these do I want to explore most. And past that, if they decide later on that I'd like to try something else, I've gone as far as I'd like to here, then they move to a different department and continue there. And there are plenty of students who also cross between the departments. So Tina, for example, is working on a children's book that the team is developing.
Oh, that's cool.
So that would be, I mean, PR for us.
Yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
really require mechanical or programming skills for that. So in that sense, she's crossing the department, what we would call department line.
So Tina, what is the main thing that Aaron brings to your team from your perspective?
Other than the organization.
Well, he's our programming mentor, and last year when I was a sophomore, there were 10 new sophomores, and we were all beginners. We had no idea what to do.
Okay.
And then Aaron came in and like organized us to tell us exactly, because the programming that we do isn't just normal C++. It's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So he just comes in and like teaches us everything that we need to learn to program this monster in 6 weeks.
And what's that like for you, Aaron?
It can be frustrating from time to time.
But it makes you take what you're learning now. You're a junior in Wayne State, right, in computer science.
Yes.
You have to know so much more to teach something than you do just to try to learn it to use it yourself, right? I mean, doesn't that help you learn?
I was going to say, you learn by, how does it go? You learn by teaching, I would imagine, in that situation.
Yes, in many ways, especially because they're, given that they don't necessarily have as much experience as I have, aren't going to be stuck in old ways, they more often than not will be more open to ideas that I might not be. And in those cases, I learn often more than they do. So while I run them through the routines of here's something you can try,
that's really neat.
I get to experience all the ideas that they have as well.
How many mentors are there that working with the team?
I think 10.
Plus
maybe
or minus.
Less, yeah,
okay.
Around 10.
All from Wayne State or from other places?
Oh, no, they're from all over. We have a couple retired Ford engineers.
Oh, that's cool.
We have one from 4i Automation.
Automation Ellie. She's our PR. Kelly, she's our PR mentor.
Wow. Sounds, what a great thing to be involved in. Folks, if you're hearing them talk about this right now, and I know, Ed, didn't your son go through with the robotics team already? He worked with the robotics team?
Nope, not at all. Just the STEM program.
Just the STEM program. Okay. But STEM programs are great to get involved in, and robotics seems like a wonderful way of applying those things that you learn. Christina Lee, good luck to you and the rest of the team of the Thunder Chickens as you go on. Aaron Wilcock, thank you very much for all that you're doing for them. And the best to the Thunder Chickens out there. Well, folks, we're going to take a quick pause here. And when we come back after the news at the top of the hour, we are going to open up our lines for you and your questions. And the number to call is 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0957. And if this is the only part of the program you hear right now at our affiliates, you can come back to the podcast and hear the next 2 hours, because they're going to be a whole lot of fun as people call in with their questions for us.
You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show. If you want to see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage at internetadvisor.net. That's where you'll also find past podcasts, our toolkit full of free software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, and other resources. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact form on the homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Now let's get back to the Internet Advisor Show podcast.
Welcome to the most fun part of the program, for my money. And that's when you get to call us live right now at 800-859-0957. Face it, it's too cold to do anything outside. Get on the phone and give us your problems. We'd love to solve them. 800-859-0957. Lines are open, and you just need to call in, and we'll find some solutions for your problems. It's been a while since we've been able to do these live call-ins, but I hope you'll take advantage of it. you may be sitting at home with a hot cup of tea or cocoa or something else to keep you internally warm.
It hasn't been that long. It was last week.
Well, I mean, in general, we have. Yes, I know. Kind of hit or miss whether we're here live. We are now. And what that means is that this toll-free number that's open, 800-859-0957, you get a free consultation with the masters of technology, Mr. Ed Rudell, Mr. Cal Carson, and Mr. Gary Baker. And I'm just here for the ride. You know, I kind of help to translate some of the geekiness.
After 17 years, you can answer.
I can answer.
All of them.
He does.
I stick my nose into them. In any case, seriously, folks, the lines are open right now, 800-859-0957. And maybe something you didn't know we did, but on this Saturday afternoon, you've got an opportunity for the next 2 hours to get a call in. And our mantra is the only dumb question is the one you don't ask. And very often when we answer your question, we're helping a whole bunch of other people out there.
And besides that, if the first couple are easy questions, we have a chance of answering them. That would be good.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we had a couple listeners that wrote us emails, mm-hmm. and one of them was from Michael. And I answered this morning.
I saw that, yep.
But it'd be something, well, this happens a lot of times. So you're running, you know you have an adware or a malicious software on your computer, and you've done what we've recommended before, and you run Malwarebytes or super anti-spyware, and you scan your computer and you remove the malicious software, but you still have a few symptoms left over. And in this instance, Michael, what happens is that every time he launches, he did exactly that. He downloaded Malwarebytes. It removed a whole bunch of stuff. But now when he launches Internet Explorer, he sees that an extra tab still launches and on Internet Explorer, so multiple tabs still open, and it opens up to one of the websites that has like an ad, you know, and wants to reinstall the ad software, basically, mm-hmm. or some coupon clippers club, you know, stuff like that. Yep. And basically what I said back to him is, you know, go back into Internet Explorer. Obviously, there's an add-on program mm-hmm. within Internet Explorer that you need to potentially try to remove. So go into Tools, add-ons, manager add-ons, mm-hmm. which are just small little applets that are installed in Internet Explorer, like toolbars and such. Check those and see if you could find something that shouldn't be there. And common sense will say, you know which ones that you mm-hmm. can remove. Just by looking at it, you can see it doesn't use a friendly name.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is it, though, anybody, you guys, chime in. They've run, as you said, Malwarebytes. They ran whatever the spyware had. Why is it that those pop-ups are still in there?
Well, it's not a pop-up. It's an add-on program. Well, but I'm just saying that's one thing to check. The other thing is to go into Internet Explorer and tell it to go restore factory settings, restore defaults, which was the first suggestion. And that way, it'll save their favorites or bookmarks. It'll disable most of the add-ons, except mm-hmm. for Microsoft's. So you may have to go back in there and re-enable Java, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or some of the Adobe plugins, you know, Adobe Reader, PDF Viewer, and stuff like that. But when you do reset, it'll reset Internet Explorer back to its defaults, usually, mm-hmm. unless there's some heavy-duty manipulation by the adware. Like, in the registry, Windows basically stores, what is the default homepage? And it's located in the registry. I mean, corporations use this. So instead of, say, if I worked for Ford Motor Company, or I worked for General Motors, or I worked for Google, when I reset my browser, I want the default homepage to go to an internal website.
Right,
I don't want it
right.
to go to Microsoft.com.
Right, right, exactly, right.
So there is a registry setting. And, and some of the malicious software actually changes that default registry setting.
Okay.
So even if you go into Internet Explorer and tell it to go back mm-hmm. to factory settings, it'll pull that value from the registry.
Is that where you have to go to something like a Malwarebytes or CombiFix or something to get them up?
The point I'm getting across is you need to go into Internet Explorer and manually check its settings.
Tools, I got you. Okay.
Tools options, go to the general tab. Make sure that you have the right homepage typed into the general tab.
Good point.
You know, check your add-ons, right? Set the default, go to the advanced tab and restore the factory settings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, check your add-on software.
I had this happen on my Mac that I was this Trovi, T-R-O-V-I. You may have heard of it, I'm sure. And I found that I had to literally uninstall Chrome because it was so badly infected, and then download and install Chrome again because it was in there as a setting, an extension. But when I opened up, I think it was Firefox, suddenly I found it in there as well.
Yep.
I thought that the only software I've used on a Mac to try to get rid of malware is Clam XAB, and it didn't get it. It did not get to it.
Well, I think sometimes, I know on the Windows side of the fence, if a person doesn't put it into safe mode when they go in to do those cleanups and they have those browsers running when they're doing the cleanup, it can't get to all those files because some of them are open at that time, so it can't affect what it needs to do against it. Not every time, but sometimes I've noticed it to do that sort of thing. And that would probably be the same thing on the Mac. The other thing that happens a lot on the Mac is I notice that, and it's only because I haven't really investigated on the Windows side, is that the browsers, when you have multiple browsers, they tend to talk to each other.
Oh.
And so it says, so if you have Safari on there and you bring up, let's say, Chrome, Chrome will immediately, the first thing it'll say is, hey, do you want all the bookmarks from Safari? You want me to bring those over here?
I got you.
So because they kind of talk back and forth between each other, if you don't really watch out what you're doing when you bring them up after you clean up, it'll just spread it back and
so
forth.
So you got to make sure you get them all.
Yes.
All right. Okay, folks, here's the phone number again. That was an email that we received, and Ed answered that for Michael. But we want to answer your questions right now. And it's phone lines are open at 800-859-0957. 800-859-0957. We're open here for business for the next 2 hours. Well, lo, these many years ago, Gary Baker, my co-host, and I began the Internet Advisor Program that started kind of on Saturdays at in the mornings. I was doing the weekend program here on WJR from the late 90s across the top of the century. And it started with people calling in. Matter of fact, I called Gary up and asked a question about my service. He was providing me with broadband service then.
That's
and
right.
It's gone on, and people at that time would call in with their questions. And we've gone now for, we're into our 18th year of doing this. But we haven't had much chance at a consistent level through the fall up to this point to do these questions, open lines. And we're doing it right now. And I hope that if you're out there, you maybe you've got a question about something that's been happening with your computer and you're wondering, why is it still happening to me? Or can I get some advice? We've got great techs in here who are troubleshooters. They've been working for many years. Ed Rudell and Cal Carson, particularly with GM executive teams, have been working on that. Cal knows the Apple system, the Macintosh, if you have something in that world. And Ed, certainly in the Windows world, and you've actually worked, probably both of you, across both of those worlds. And Gary Baker here as well, that is very familiar with these worlds. So the phone line is open right now for you. It's kind of like you can go to your local computer shop, or you can just pick up the phone and call us at 800-859-0957.
Yep.
We'll do our best to help you.
And I was just thinking how much they charge when you take it to a when you take it to a big box store. They may look at it for $80, but you want them to service it. That's like $200 before you can get your unit back.
So, and the amazing thing is that sometimes the service that they're providing you, not because they're being unscrupulous or anything like that, but it's something that you probably could have easily done yourself. Had you just applied a little bit of knowledge and some curiosity, and you can be able to knock it off and save yourself some dollars.
Absolutely.
And that's really important to be able to do.
All right, let's start our calls. And by the way, we're going to be here until 7 o'clock this evening with this open line. So as you're going along, maybe you have a question, jot it down. And when you get someplace you can safely call us, give us a call at 800-859-0957. Let's start with Roger from Clawson. Hey, Roger, how are you doing? Welcome to the Internet Advisor.
Thank you. I'm doing quite well. Trying to stay warm, but I have a tablet that it's a Galaxy Tab 3.
Mm-hmm.
I've had it for a few months, and it's functioning just fine for what I need it to do, and it's primarily to use emails. And
okay.
And in the last couple of days, the format of the email, I'm through Yahoo Mail.
Mm-hmm.
It changed from a full screen across, like it is on my computer, to a column on the left side and a great big Yahoo with an envelope on the right. And it's because it's a touch screen, it takes me like 42 times to touch that the email I want to open.
Oh, dear.
And I was wondering if there's a way to go back to what I had
right
in the beginning.
Same.
You know, I'm not sure how to do that. I knew it sounds like the website, you know, how if you had a mouse, how when you hover over a left-hand column or between the individual fields, how you get those two vertical lines and then you click the mouse and like in a spreadsheet and you can stretch the website over.
Oh,
like
the front. Move the columns.
Yeah, you can move the columns. But on a tablet, that's very difficult to do with your finger unless you have a stylus. So,
yeah.
Well, I have a stylus and I use the stylus and you even if you try to slide it left to the right, to bring it over, it will not move.
Do you have a settings that you can go to? This is an Android, so you can go to settings, right?
Yeah, oh, I can go back to settings. Yeah,
and it would normally be under a view. Do you?
I'm wondering if you can go back to settings,
but then go to the view. Do they have
exactly
a view?
And reset the default? We talked about that before,
yeah. Right? And I believe you can also on an Android device possibly go into like the application manager, and you can clear the cache. So you go into settings, and then you look for. I'm bringing up my Android device right now. And
I'm there now with the application manager.
Right, and then in there you have a listing of all the individual applications, and mm-hmm. there is the ability to, clear the cache, and so you could possibly uninstall it and then reinstall
there
it again.
There you go.
But which browser are you using? Are you using the default browser provided by the tablet, the Galaxy 3?
Yeah, there's default applications I can go to also, but that...
Well, I'm
that
sorry, which icon are you using on the...
Icon.
Yeah, like for, how do you access your mail? Are you using the email application, or are you using a browser and then going into your email?
I'm using the mailbox with Yahoo on it, and it goes right to it.
Oh, so you have an application called Mailbox with Yahoo?
Yeah.
So basically you're using the mail application itself.
Yeah.
So you might want to go into the mail application and clear your cache. This is difficult to do. I just have my Android phone right here.
We have all sorts of operating systems here. But it does sound like you need to go back into your settings and into the mail and see if you can reset it to the default. And if you can do that, it may go back then to that view that is a standard view.
Yeah, and search within the application manager and also look for the ability to clear the cache.
Okay, Roger. Give that a try.
Right, thank you very much.
And let us know.
I will give it a try.
Yeah, and let us know, by the way, you can get back to us by email.
Please,
going to internetadvisor.net and the contact us, and we'd love to follow up with you on that. We want to get to some of the other folks who are with us right now, too. And we have a friend of ours, Ben Carpenter. How you doing, Ben?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Doing well, sir. You have a couple of questions for us, I understand.
Well, I forgot what one of them was that I sent, but I know that one of them was about my XP machine.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if I could take the hard drive out of that and put it in one of them boxes to hook it up with USB port and have the programs open.
All right, so you want to take the hard drive out of one of your old XP machines, put it into an enclosure, right?
Yes.
And then from there, you want to be able to use it to connect it by USB?
Yes.
Back to what?
To a Windows 7 machine.
Ah, to a Windows 7 machine.
Yeah, but the only caveat that's in this game that I heard him say is that he'd want to be able to execute the programs that are going to be on the external drive. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've got two programs on that XP machine that I run about twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to be able to run them on my Windows 7 machine if I could, but I don't have disks or anything to put it on that machine. And
I see. You don't,
And if he doesn't have the ability to reinstall those programs, they're not going to work being on an external hard drive.
I mean, unless they're DOS-based programs, which are or utility, like some programs that you download, when you execute them from the default folder, may work. Very few of them do, and Microsoft doesn't want that. Think about it. I mean, the whole purpose of this is to share common software libraries, which are located in Windows and Windows system folders, and very few programs. Like on the Mac, if you had a Mac, you could do that. You know, if you hooked up a Mac to an external drive, because the programs are pretty much self-contained within the folders for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, on a PC, you really can't do that.
Mm, okay.
The only thing I've done, I've had a few people that have had problems like this. I've scoured the internet for the program names and have been able to find the programs on the internet and reinstall them on the other computer.
Okay.
You know, find free versions of the program or find a download.
But he'd have to have it on that drive that he's going
to
be having.
Well, you'd have to install it onto Windows 7 machine, reinstall it, and then you copy the other folders on top of the one you just installed, and hopefully it works, but it's really hit or miss, and you're prone to viruses because a lot of these old programs people are interested in installing on newer computers, and they're seeded with viruses and malware.
Oh, dear.
Not to mention, isn't there a licensing issue that might go along with that as well?
I haven't had that XP machine fired up and hooked to the internet since they quit having the updates for it.
Since the Bushes were out of office.
Yeah. Well, here's the question I got for you, Ben. The programs that you're using on that XP machine, do they require the internet?
No, they do not require the internet, but I have to have them hooked up to my router because I got a wireless printer hooked up to that router. So I unplugged the cord from the telephone when I fire that up to use it. Mm-hmm. So it's never hooked up to the internet.
Well, if you only use it twice a year and it's never hooked up to the internet when you use it, why don't you just continue using it that way and don't worry about it?
In other words, just keep it on the XP machine.
Yeah, it's going to fail eventually. I mean, if anything, he could clone the hard drive to another unit.
A new hard drive.
Just so it doesn't fail.
There you go.
A mechanical hard drive. It's going to fail at some point.
So what I hear you guys saying then is that, Ben, you could just take the programs that are there, clone that hard drive onto a new drive. So you've got mechanically a new drive.
Yeah.
And then put that in the XP machine and leave the XP machine only to be used a couple of times a year.
Yeah,
okay, Ben.
Sounds like he really wants to hook it up on the 7, but it's not going to work.
No,
usually.
Well, sounds like they have to keep it on the XP machine. Okay, hey Ben, we got the one of your questions at least. We'll try to with the email to get the rest of them. Okay.
Okay.
All right, Ben. Take care of yourself. Stay warm. And for the rest of you, hey Jim and Jill, we'll be with you in just a moment. And for the rest of you, the number is 800-859-0957. Your questions, our answers. Now, this is Foster Brown, the co-host of the program. Gary Baker, Edward Dale, and Cal Carson in studio, where sleeves are rolled up and ready to help you. And the way we help you is by answering the phones at 800-859-0957. Toll free, wherever you're hearing me. And we'd love to help you if you're in Ontario, Southwest Ontario, or you're in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, wherever you happen to be. We'd love to help you.
Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Within the sound of your golden voice.
There you go. 800-859-0957. We've got Jill and Jim waiting, and there's space for you as well. Okay, guys, I know that you are the ultimate lovers. You've already figured out what to do for Valentine's Day, right?
That's next week, right?
Well, then maybe we have something that can help you here. These are 5 last-minute Valentine gifts that you can do. There you go. The first one is an app, to get an app for somebody. You know, favorite thing that they would like on their phone.
Wow.
Think of an app. All right.
So there's a great app called Hey Let's, and it's for last minute planners. So if you haven't figured out what you're going to do, hey, let's do this. And they come up with some great ideas and download the app, and maybe you can find something that will get you out of the doghouse for not having blended surveyor.
We'll get that up online. All right. A couple other things before we get back to our calls right now. E-books. For instance, Steve Sadler was with us last week. You can get his ebook by going to iBooks, and you can get it there.
Mindset. And actually, he was in L.A. Maybe there's a movie deal.
Oh, yeah, you can get a movie deal out of that.
Who knows?
That's from our program last week. Music, for instance, a song or an album from iTunes Store or from Spotify or something like that. A digital subscription to magazines. Mm-hmm. Many magazines are no longer in the stands.
These are clearly romantically geek gifts, right?
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
Can you say romantically and geek in the same sentence? I don't know. I can't even.
Trying.
We keep going.
All right, we'll try some more. We'll see if there's more that you guys can come up with. Let's go to Jim in Grosse Pointe. Welcome to the Internet Advisor, Jim. How you doing?
Yes, happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you very much. Trying to help these guys with some presents ideas.
There you go. I have a MacBook Pro, and every so often it comes up with this spinning disc that spins forever. And, I've got two cleaners that I use, but it keeps coming back.
Did you say spinning disc, or is it a spinning beach ball, like multicolored?
Yeah, it's a multicolored disc that spins.
Okay, and do you have your MacBook Pro in front of you right now?
Actually, I don't.
Okay, how much memory is in your MacBook Pro?
Boy, I don't know.
Okay, my gut guess is, let's go a little bit further. So when you're using your MacBook Pro, you probably have Safari open because you're browsing the net.
Right.
And you probably got a mail program
that,
open.
Yeah.
And what else do you have? What else do you have open when you're normally using the computer?
Just Safari, nothing else.
Okay. My gut guess would probably say that you probably need more memory in that machine. You probably don't have enough. That would generally, that's generally the first thing that starts kicking the old beach ball up in front of you.
Okay, so it's not a virus that came in and does that.
I don't think so.
No, not normally.
No, not normally.
So this is something that happens not on power up, but as he uses the computer, this will come up occasionally. Is that, am I understanding?
Right,
that,
and then if I use my two cleaners, it'll go away for a little while, and then it comes back.
The other thing that you might want to do, if it's not that, which cleaners are you using?
One's called, is it Mac Cleaner or something like that? I forgot, there's two of them.
Well, if it's Mac Clean, not Mac Cleaner, there's one that starts with the name of Mac.
Yeah.
And it's just a bad news situation. It doesn't do much of anything, and it ties up a lot of stuff on your machine. I would probably take that off.
What's a good one then?
If you want to check for viruses and stuff like that, I would use something like Clam AV or.
CLAM?
Yes, called Clam XAV?
AV. Okay.
Yes. Clam X AV.
Clam X AV, and it's free.
That's free. Who do you
Great.
Get? Who do you get your internet from?
Comcast.
You could try Norton antivirus on your machine. You get that free from Comcast, and it's the full blown program.
How about?
See, I'm using that. I've got a PC, and that's the main one that comes in on that. So no, I'll use that other one. Clam XAV sounds good.
But you're gonna want to take the other two cleaners off first.
Yeah, right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yes. So they don't compete, right?
Oh, so I shouldn't use more than one at a time.
Correct.
Because you start fighting with one another. Hey, by the way, just a quick question: could he repair permissions?
Oh,
might that be a problem?
That was going to be the next place I was going to go as well. You might want to go into disk utilities. I mean, go into your utilities folder, then go to disk utility. And then click on your hard drive on the left-hand column, and then click the button that says Verify Disk Permissions.
And what was that last part?
You're going to start up. You're going to go on your hard drive. You're going to go into Applications.
Right, right.
Go into Utilities.
Right.
And start up Disk Utility.
Right.
And then you're going to see on the left-hand side, there's going to be a column that shows you your hard drive. And you're going to click once on that hard drive to select it. And then you're going to click on the button that says Verify Disk Permissions.
And when it's done through that, then you can put Repair.
Yeah. Well, if it goes through and comes back with the green line that says everything's okay, then you can just close it up. But if it comes back with the red line saying things need to be repaired, then you're going to click the button below it that says Repair Disk Permissions. Run that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then after
that's separate from this Clam XAV, right?
Yeah, correct. It's entirely separate.
That's built into the operating system. Yeah. It's a utility that comes with it.
Okay.
You don't want to hear my 10-second disappointment with my Mac Pro, do you?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I needed to make a movie, and I looked around, and everybody told me, Jim, you got to buy a Mac and do it there.
Mm-hmm.
So they talked me out of the PC. So I went to buy my Mac Pro to do that. And I went to two different Apple stores, and they both tell me, you buy this machine, you'll be able to do it. You'll be able to make your DVD. Everything will be great.
Mm-hmm.
I buy it. I get on there. You cannot make DVDs on the machine. They took off the program for it. You'd have to buy another separate program. And neither store knew that.
Now, how old is your MacBook Pro?
3 years.
3 years old.
Well, they came out, I don't know why, but they came out with that new line, and they did not put in the software to burn the disks. It was crazy, and none of the people knew that. That's how great
that's
that
strange.
Was. And in addition, I found out after that, when I'm using it, I had a variety of different formats I needed of movies to pull them in. Well, my PC would pull them in, but the Mac was very picky about the formats that it would use, so I was disappointed.
Okay. So you got a number, Jim, you got a number of issues here to deal with, and I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to invite you to get hold of us by email as well. Now, we've given you a couple of things to do here, okay, with
okay.
The Clam XAV, pardon me, and then also repairing permissions. And then after that, get back to us, and we'll talk with you more on email about the issue of getting rid of the spinning beach ball, see if that took care of it, see if you need more RAM, and then the other thing we'll be talking to you about burning movies, okay? Thank you very much for giving us a call. 859-0957. That's 800-859-0957 is our number. And I want to move on to Jill in Macomb. Welcome to the Internet Advisor. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, happy Valentine's Day to you, too. I've been listening for quite a few years, and I'm happy to get through.
Good. We're glad to have you here. What can we do for you?
My question might tie in with the previous caller.
Okay.
I have a desktop Mac, mm-hmm. and I've been getting the spinning beach ball way too often.
Okay.
My Mac's about 4 years old.
Okay. Is it the iMac?
Yes, it's the iMac, okay. Intel.
Is it the 20-inch or the 24-inch one?
I thought it was like 21.
Okay.
Right. Not the real big one.
Okay, right. Not the big one. Okay.
Do you know how much memory you have in yours?
Yeah, while I was on hold, I looked, and I have, there's 4 gigabytes installed, and then I have the memory slots, which are empty.
Ah,
all right.
Okay.
What do you do with your computer? Tell me how you use it.
I have a lot of photos. I browse the web. I put things up on eBay, and sometimes I blog.
Now, when you say you have a lot of photos, would you say over 3,000?
I looked at storage, and it says my photos are 116.5 gigabytes worth.
Wow. Okay. Now, and do you get that beach? Do you get
lot.
That beach ball a lot when you're using the photos?
You know what? I was getting it, so I haven't been using it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this
got frustrated.
Two things I'm going to suggest to you. Number one, iPhoto, which comes on the Mac,
right.
And it's probably what you're using to do those photos with. It has a threshold of when you get about 3,000 photos, it gets a little sluggish. And
okay.
I would suggest that you switch over to something like Photoshop Elements,
okay.
to manipulate and handle those photos. And also to add an additional 4 gig of RAM to your machine.
Now, Jill, I'm going to put you on hold, okay?
Okay.
And we're going to get to you during the break and see if we can wrap up that issue for you. We've got Don in Clinton Township and Alex in Dearborn, and we've got a whole other hour to answer questions here as well. Welcome back, and we'll begin with Alex in Dearborn in just a moment, but phone lines are open for you. 800-859-0957. And we're going to be going, by the way, until 7 o'clock this evening. So I thought we'd just take a little more time to give you folks out there an opportunity to call. And it's Windows or Mac's environment. If you have a cell phone, too, I know that's kind of, we've been drawn into a lot of questions about tablets and about cell phone technology because mm-hmm. it's all kind of blurring together now with all the companies. Yeah, Cal.
Just to follow up on the previous call,
yeah,
I was talking with Jill. And we talked it out a little bit more. And what she's going to do, she's going to I told her to go to crucial.com and put in her model number of her Mac and find out the type of memory that it uses.
Mm-hmm.
And she can either order it directly from them or she can print out the paper so she'll know the type of memory she has. And she's going to go over to a local store like Micro Center and purchase the memory herself. But I told her before she did that, if she felt comfortable putting it in herself, I wanted her to go to youfixit.com and look up for her particular Mac how to install the memory and watch the video a couple of times. If she feels comfortable enough that she can take that on herself, then she can go buy the memory, come back, put it in,
mm-hmm.
try that out first and see if that increases her performance because she has already upgraded up to Yosemite, which I know she needs more memory
right.
for.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And then once she does that, if it works out, great. If not, then she'll go to the next highest step, which was to delete some of the photos off her machine
mm-hmm.
and put them onto an external drive.
By the way, Apple is coming out with a new program to handle photos. And it's simply going to be called Photo.
Yes.
And iPhoto, I think it is. iPhoto, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And that will be coming out with a new update that's coming.
Yep.
And they acknowledge that iPhoto has not been good at handling the large numbers of
Get up over that many photos.
I have 6,000. So I think
It gets real wonky when you get up in the high thousands.
And exactly. Cal, really, one of the best ways to get some better performance is to add more RAM memory.
Yeah, that's
to
one
any
of the quickest.
Machine, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine not having 10 or at least 8 gig today.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And that's whether you're using Windows, Mac, or whatever.
Whatever.
Right. 8 is like the baseline for me.
Isn't
for
it incredible? 8 gigabytes is the base nowadays.
And I have it on both my machines, right?
Yeah.
8 gig minimum. So.
And what was that Bill Gates said 64 meg ought to be enough for everybody?
Yeah, you're right. Ed, one of the things that Cal mentioned, I think you said this before, YouTube is a great place to go.
YouTube, UFixit. I mean, that's how I replaced UFixit is where I went to learn how to replace the gas solenoids on my dryer. For $5 instead of spending $150 on the entire thing.
Yeah. And you're listening to a technician there who has done, he's fixed everything out there. But
YouTube hammers, hammers and magnets don't jive. Don't do that. You demagnetize them. So.
All right. Let's go back. Video is very good. Helps you in many, many different things. All right. Let's go back to Alex from Dearborn. Welcome to the Internet Advisor. How can we help you?
Hi, guys. I'm a real amateur at this. I have an Apple computer. It's 5 years old. It's a OS X version 10.5.
Okay.
It's got 2 gigabytes of memory. What happened? I just use it basically for email and trying to find my way around with mapping.
Okay.
And printing letters.
Okay.
But
and it's probably really good for that, right? I mean,
sorry?
It's probably a really good machine still for that.
Yeah, it's very convenient, but lately it's been, every time I move the arrow to click on or to scroll my emails, it freezes and it presents these boxes next to the arrow, like tools, like it says back or reload page, and they won't clear out, or I get new folder, these little boxes next to the arrow. And they just keep, anywhere I move the arrow, they'll keep coming up, and I can't do my task of opening my email or doing what I want to do. And I went to took the computer to Apple, and they told me, well, this is an older computer, and they said I should get an update, an OX 10.6, which is still not what the new ones are like, but they said that would be a compromise, and that might cut it down.
Okay, what is OS, the 10.6, is that Snow Leopard?
That would be Snow Leopard,
Snow Leopard, right.
Yeah. Yes, that's a Snow Leopard. Right.
Well, that would help. I think with those boxes that you're seeing.
And then they disappear, you know, and then they'll come back again. It varies, sometime for a long time or a short time.
A lot of times what's happening is that you have a browser on there that, for that version of the OS, you have a browser you can only go so far with. And what happens, you have websites that have content and features in it that browser cannot support properly. And because of that, you'll get unpredictable performance. You'll get weird little things popping up like that. By upgrading the OS, you'll get a browser that will be closer to what's going on nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So that may help. But in 5 years, that's a long time in the internet world, and you might be getting close to a time where it's time to bite the bullet and say, you know, it's time for a new machine, whether that be a Mac or a Windows. But, you know, it's your browser that's getting to be too old in the tooth.
What about an alternate browser? Because Safari, you can only update to a certain point. Why couldn't he download an alternate browser like
Chrome?
A Firefox or a Chrome, something on the Mac OS that's independent of the OS, right? But it's still receiving updates from this third party, either Firefox or Mozilla, Chrome.
That's a good choice. You can try that as a workaround. Try downloading Chrome and see whether or not you get the same results.
So would I have to buy this?
No.
Absolutely free. Just go to google.com. And when you get there, it's going to say to you, hey, why don't you try Google Chrome? Click here.
They'll read your computer and notice you don't have Google Chrome.
And they will be happy to offer that to you.
They'll offer it to you.
And you'll click it, download it, install it, and see if that works better for you.
Okay.
So that would be, I could do that right away.
Yes, you could.
And the other thing is, he can update, he can go up to 10.6, can he, on that machine, or can he?
Well, it all depends. Number one, I can't, well, let's see, 5 years ago, it should be an Intel-based machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did.
And, but Snow Leopard, I think he might have had to buy Snow Leopard.
But, oh, really?
Yeah.
But it's cheap, though, right?
But he can get it now for, like, I think it's like $19.
Yeah, it's from iTunes, they sell it.
Yeah, you okay, go into the iTunes store, and you would essentially pay about
CD.
20.
I think it's a CD that you...
Yeah, they'll ship him out a CD. Yeah. He can't download.
Now, is there anything else? I mean, if he was to consider this, obviously he's had the computer for 5 years. Isn't there some other general maintenance things that he should do, like a disk cleanup or temporary internet files? Because on the PC environment, if I had a person that had a five-year-old computer, I'd be like, man, let's rebuild this sucker, you know? Right. But on a Mac, they just really do work. But are there any type of general things that he might want to consider doing as well?
Well, he could go into preferences under Safari, click on the advanced tab, and then click a little button that says show the developer menu on the menu bar. And that will put a word up there that says develop. Once it does that, then he can go back in and say under develop, he can say empty cache, and it will empty out all his caches for Safari.
Right.
And then he can go back and turn that back off again so he doesn't have that there anymore.
You know, that's a good point, because I was thinking of the operating system in general, but what you basically said is cleaning out your Internet Explorer or your web browser cache, it might be 6 years old as well. So you might want to clean that out. Okay, hey, that's a good idea.
Alex, we're going to ask you to, in turn, get in touch with us by email at our Contact Us button, because we're coming up to the top of the hour. And... we've got Mark from Monroe and Don from Clinton Township. Guys, if you can hang on, we will be back with another hour of answering questions after the news at the top of the hour. And for the rest of you out there, I hope you'll get a question to us at 800-859-0957. As you heard, sometimes we can't answer all the issues right now, and we just encourage you then to get on to the email with us after that. But very often as well, in the process of dealing with the answers to your questions, we help a lot of people with their issues as well. Foster Brown, Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson back for another hour of answering your questions at 800-859-0957. The Internet Advisor on the air, helping you for one more hour this afternoon.
You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show. If you want to see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage at internetadvisor.net. That's where you'll also find past podcasts, our toolkit full of free software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, and other resources. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact form on the homepage. You can also friend us on Facebook. Now let's get back to the Internet Advisor Show podcast.
Hi, this is Foster Brown, the co-host of the program. Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson in studio for yet another hour of answering your questions at 800-859-0957. We're going to come back shortly, and we'll be having Don from Clinton Township with us and Mark from Monroe. But hey, that leaves room for you from wherever you may be calling us. 800-859-0957. Experienced techs in studio waiting to answer your question here for an hour on the Internet Advisor. All right, a question for the esteemed techs who are in here.
We're not that steamed right now. Oh, esteemed.
Esteemed, yes. What are the top five industries impacted by drones? I'll just leave that as a question out there. The top five industries impacted by drones, and they're having bigger impact all the time. All right, we've got folks waiting right now to have a conversation with us. They've got some problems or concerns they want to talk with us about, and let's go right out to Don and Clinton Township. Welcome to the Internet Advisor, and thank you for your patience.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very good, sir. Happy good Valentine's Day here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to thank you for some of your suggestions on programs like ComboFix, etc., that have helped you immensely without spending any money. They've worked marvelously for
good.
Me on my machine.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Thank you.
Are you guys up for a question regarding a multifunction copier on a network?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I have a Xerox WorkCenter 5150 copier that one of the features it has is a scanning ability.
Mm-hmm.
And when we go to scan, it worked fine. It was set up. It worked fine. We go to scan now, and it scans. It feeds the paper. It does all that. But when it goes to scan, we get an error message that says unable to connect the server.
Yeah.
I tried to check the IP addresses and all that. It seems to be proper, and I just can't figure out why I keep getting that, all of a sudden get that error message.
If I remember the Xerox multifunctional units, there's two ways you can set them up. You could set them up to connect to a SMTP mail server, mm-hmm. so they actually have their own user ID and mail account that they send from the Xerox printer to a mail account, so that at that point, the scan is emailed internally to someone in the organization. The other way that it can be done is you can install Xerox software onto a workstation that's on the same network that discovers the Xerox printer. And there's a relationship or a pairing that takes place between the workstation and the Xerox multifunctional printer. And I thought that the setup on that was initiated from the workstation that you install. Was it WorkCenter, I think?
Yeah, yes, sir. I think you hit something right on the head. We have it set up as a SMTP, which is how the tech, mm-hmm. the tech set it up. Not a Xerox tech, but the installation tech.
Right.
And I wasn't aware of that second comment you made regarding the Xerox software.
Yeah, well, there's two ways of setting it up.
And the best way, I think, is through SMTP, the Simple Mail Transfer Protocol.
Right.
Oh,
so what,
it is?
Yes, yeah, that would be the best way.
Well, that's one way of setting up. So inside small organizations that have their own mail server on site, or if your network has access to the internet. So, I mean, just a user ID and password change on the user account, if it's set up as an SMTP server, or the account was disabled by the mail server admins because they go, "What is this? I keep on sending email addresses to this user account. I never get a response. I'm disabling it," because they forgot that they set up a print server scanner mailbox for your multifunctional printer. So it really depends how you have it set up, and that's what you need to identify first.
Okay. Very good. Oh, that's excellent. Can I ask one other quick one?
You know, we got a bunch of people in line.
No.
That's quite all right. Well, now, here, Don, what I want you to do is go to our site, internetadvisor.net, and click on the Contact Us button and send us an email and reference the fact that you were on the air with us, okay?
Or we could probably hang
Thanks
on.
Again, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you so much, Don, for that. I want to make sure we get to a lot of the other people who have been waiting for quite a while here. And Mark, thank you for your patience. From Monroe, glad to have you here on the Internet Advisor. How can we help you?
Hello.
Hi.
I'm having a problem with my laptop.
Yes.
It went into reconfiguration mode, and from then on, I cannot get Wi-Fi. I cannot get onto the internet at all.
So when you say first, what type of operating system are you running? Windows XP, Windows 7, Windows
Vista?
Vista. So when you power up, what was the splash screen you got on your laptop?
Windows.
Okay.
Windows what, please? I'm sorry?
Oh, be honest with you, I don't know.
Okay. How old is the machine?
5 years.
Okay. Well, it's not that bad. So it's probably Windows 7.
Are you near the computer? Is it turned on?
Yeah, it's turned on.
Okay. So when you say reconfiguring, is that like when you power up the computer, it says it's reconfiguring, or when you're in the computer and you're trying to attach the network? I mean, when does this message pop up?
Yeah, I was already on the internet, and it said it's going to shut down and reconfigure.
Got you. Okay, so more than likely what's happened, well, I'm speculating at this point, that there might have been a Microsoft security update or a patch that was installed, and... But usually those do not force reboots right away. They usually wait to the reboot. So
since he's got the computer turned on, can he do a right mouse click on my computer and tell you what operating system he's using right now?
Sure.
Okay, why don't you do that? Can you do that easily, Mark?
Yep.
Okay, so and then after the part where it says reconfiguring, did the computer successfully shut down and restart at that point?
Matter of fact, that's where all the problems started. Okay. It wouldn't turn back on.
Okay. So you're sitting, so it didn't turn on now, but are you in front of the computer, and is it powering up now?
Yeah, we had to take the battery out, and now we're able to actually get it somewhat on,
okay.
But it won't get on the web, internet.
All right, here's what we're going to do, Mark. We're going to put you on hold, and then during the break, what we're going to do is Ed's going to step aside and talk with you. And when we come back, we'll share some of the things that Ed and Mark talked about during the break This is in order to be able to get as many of you folks on the air to answer your questions. 800-859-0957. Jason from Rochester Hills will be talking to you in just a moment. Thank you again so much for joining us now in our third hour today. And we are dedicating these last 2 hours to answering your questions. And by the way, you may have heard me, when we get to this question, it seems a little bit complicated or involved. We answer as much as we can on the air right now and then hope that the people will call us back by going to internetadvisor.net and putting a question in there on the Contact Us button. And then throughout the week, Ed and Cal and some of the rest of us will grab those things and do our best to answer them for you. I want to thank the guys behind the glass, Masters Dorsch, who is handling the phone calls. Thank you very much, Mike Stetz. And also Rich Lozinski, who's been handling us in the last hour as well. Our engineers making everything happen. Cal.
Hey, tomorrow, February 15th. Good time. The Mac Group is having their monthly meeting. And this meeting, our subject matter will be reduce, reuse, recycle your computer equipment. And we're going to talk about all sorts of different ways you can repurpose that particular piece of computer equipment you may have. It doesn't just have to be a Mac. It could be anything, be a printer or whatever, that sort of thing. So
excellent.
Folks might want to come out to that. They can link to the Mac Group website through internetadvisor.net. And in addition to that, it's a great thing to do. You know, recycling is terrific. Matter of fact, I just saw Steve Beck.
Steve Beck?
He's with Global Tech Ministries.
Yeah, Steve Beck, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I saw him a couple of weeks ago, dropped off some equipment to him, and he's doing just great.
Yes, he is. Longtime friend of ours, Steve Beck, at Global Tech Ministries, and he's got, a laundry list that we posted on our Facebook page. By the way, we have a Facebook page, and simply go to Internet Advisor on Facebook and look us up there.
And if anybody ever wants to get rid of computer equipment, he's a great guy to get in contact with, and he is a 501c3 organization, so you can get that tax deduction if you need it.
And he did great.
And the Mac Group is one of the oldest in the country.
Right. And what's nice about that, a lot of people that want to get rid of equipment, they're always concerned about their data. And so Steve will talk to you about that. You know, he'll say, don't worry, you know, I will erase your data.
He does. There's a great job of that. He has helped schools in Africa and in the United States and places that would never be able to have computer access. But your older machine sometimes is a gift from heaven for some of these folks who have had no kind of computer systems at all. And he's able to refurb them very well. Before we go to Jason from Rochester Hills, with your conversation, you were talking with, I believe, Mark from Monroe. Did you get anything further, Eddie, offline?
No, but I'm probably going to have them, if you want to get Mark back in, have them call their internet service provider, if possible. Because what's happening is that his home computer sees the different wireless networks. He sees Netgear. He sees and other ones. He's just not connecting to the internet at this point. So he might want to go to the back of his his Netgear wireless router and hit the reset button, but then go back to his cable modem and hit the reset button on the back of that thing.
Yes.
And
sometimes he has to call the cable company.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And it's an automated system to automatically just ping it. And it'll establish the connection sometimes.
And they can initiate a reset as well.
I did that recently with Comcast when I was having some problems. I went to them and she said, Mr. Brown, hang on a second while I reset this. And boom, it's reset from there.
And that's why, Mark, if you're still listening, I'm sure you are, I told him we'd get him back on the air, but we want to get to Jason right now.
Right.
That call your internet service provider, but you might want to reset your cable modem before you call them.
Because they're going to ask you to do that.
Because it sounds like Windows is working. It's just as he says. He's lost internet access.
And the process.
And he lost its connection.
The process usually is to shut it down. At least the process was, you shut down your computer, then you shut down the modem, then you shut down the cable modem. And then when you put it back on.
First,
you mean a router, pardon
PC,
me.
Router,
and then the
cable
modem.
Yep. Right. And then you put them back on by starting at the wall.
Right.
And you start with your cable modem, then to your router, then to your PC. That's how they come back on. Okay, let's get to, by the way, 800-859-0957 is our number. And Jason from Rochester Hills, thank you for waiting patiently. Happy Valentine's Day, and welcome to the Internet Advisor.
To you as well. Yes, I have the Lenovo Y500 laptop, and we're running Windows 8.1. And for some reason, when I shut the lid, the power totally shuts off, and also when I go to change the power, I just shut down normally. It it doesn't go through the proper process to shut down. It actually stays on for like 20 minutes, and then it just drops power.
Have you tried in Windows 8.1 to go into the search, or just from your Windows modern interface, and just type in power settings? And as soon as you start typing, it'll bring up your the Windows search capability. And what you probably want to modify, or at least look at the existing settings for, you know, power settings. What to do when I shut the lid? You want to go to sleep is what you should be instead of powering off. Have you tried that yet, Jason?
Yes, I'm actually in power off. Would it be under the power option?
Yeah, probably, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I'm in the advanced setting right now, and mm-hmm. I've looked at it. I've also done all the virus scans and everything, but I did have a failed update with a Windows update like 2 months ago, and then a month mm-hmm. later I also have this issue, but I have forced update with Windows, and it says I'm up to date with my update.
Okay, so how long has this problem been happening since day one?
Probably about the last month. I'm trying not to do a reinstall to sure. designate if it's a software issue or a hardware. Mm-hmm. If it's hardware, I do have options, mm-hmm. but I kind of want to rule out software.
Who makes the computer? What's the manufacturer?
Lenovo.
You might want to consider going to Lenovo's website and see if there's any patches or anything
firmware.
That needs firmware updates that you can download from their website. Something may have changed that may require a firmware update because the operating system may have changed.
Well, you know, that Cal brings up a good point, and it's really, it wouldn't be firmware. What you're looking for, as he said, Microsoft may have applied a patch or a software update on your computer, and it may have changed a file by Lenovo. So you might want to go and search for your model number and then download the software for Windows 8.1 for your laptop for, you know, system files and check and BIOS update. And what else would it be? Power settings and advanced chipset.
Any number of things, yeah.
Yeah,
sound.
You should be able to just to enter your model number, and it will tell you what the updates were, right?
Yeah, and there may not even be an update. It just may say drivers for,
there you go,
you know, software installation for, okay, you know, this particular model. It's quite possible that a setting changed after either a maintenance update by Microsoft or failed maintenance update. And, okay, and that might take it. But it sounds like you're in the right area. Now, did you find the area that I was referring to about lid closure and power button options?
I see the one with the sleep settings. I'm in the advanced setting on the power options.
Yep, and it's called, you know, what to do.
I don't see something called lid. I don't see anything that says lid.
Yeah, it's a...
Oh, there it is.
Yeah, just down from the power button turn on, okay, password protection, if you say it shows power button and lid settings.
Okay, I see it right here. It says put to sleep is what it's set to on lid closure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Power button is set to sleep. AMI sleep button is set to sleep.
Okay, there you go.
That's the way it should be.
Then that's the way it should be. But you're saying when you shut the lid, it's basically shutting off.
Yes, just like if I held on the power button.
Or it could be crashing, it sounds like then.
It does that. I checked to make sure nothing was pressing the button, like if mm-hmm. something was actually pressing it. That's not happening. But also, if I go and shut down my computer, what's weird is it doesn't power down normally. It kind of goes on, the screen goes black, my keyboard stays lit, and I'll stay that way for like 20 minutes, and then I get a hard crash.
Yeah, but I noticed when you were reading off the settings to me, you said power button goes to sleep.
Right.
Instead of power button, should be shut down.
Right.
Oh, it should be shut down, yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yep. So what's happening is the unit is failing to go to sleep, and there are several things that'll do that, that'll cause that. Drivers are more than likely what the cause is, but he's having, there's some software that is failing. So go to the Lenovo website. and see if you could download the
advanced try those out and see if they work, and then get back to us again through our Contact Us button on our homepage at internetadvisor.net. All right? Thank you very much. All right. Back with your questions, 800-859-0957. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor, our question and answer time. My name is Foster Brown, co-host of the program, along with Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson in studio. And Cal has a word to the wise in just a moment. I want to just quickly tell you folks something that has happened just recently. We finally got our podcast feed to iTunes fixed.
Woohoo!
Yes. Thank you to the folks at Visual Compass. Thank you. I've known them as VC Web Design for so long. It's Visual Compass. They are the folks, Vince Schmilewski and his crew out in Ypsilanti, have been helping us, and they got it working. So now, if you go to iTunes, you simply can go to the podcast, and you can look for the Internet Advisor podcast. And when you got it, you can then simply sign up for it, and you'll get not only this week's podcast with all the show notes and everything else, you'll also get past programs as well. It's really wonderful when it works. It's finally working again. Hey, Cal, before we get to our callers, and we have some folks calling in right now, and by the way, we got about another 25 minutes, 800-859-0957, to get to your question. You had something to tell us great importance at this time of year.
You know, a lot of times I hear people say things like, you know, I had this telephone, and then I had a problem with it, and it stopped working, and then I took it in, and they told me they couldn't retrieve any of my information off of it, and they had to give me a new phone. And they always would curse the manufacturer, or they would curse it. And you know something? The bottom line is we're all responsible for our own data. And the way you be responsible for your data, or the best way to be responsible for it, is to make sure you back it up on a regular basis. And it doesn't matter how you do it, you just have to do it. Whether you back it up on an external hard drive, whether you use cloud services, whether you use the internet, whatever you use to do it, you need to back up your information. You need to back it up on a regular basis. Or, as I say, you back it up as regular as you can tolerate the loss.
Yeah.
So if you can go without a whole week's worth of information, then only back up once a week. If you can't go that long, you probably should back up more frequently. And nowadays, with things like our tax returns that we all do using TurboTax or one of the many different products out there, it's important to make sure you back up those files, because you never know when that hard drive is going to die. Absolutely. And one day the IRS is going to knock on your door and say, "We'd like to do an audit. Could you please reproduce those documents for us?" And you go like, "Duh, I can't find it because my hard drive died."
Yeah,
and they'll say, "That's fine. We'll just default to the maximum amount you have to pay."
So you don't want to go down that type of path.
And just all the other things that make up your digital lifestyle, the pictures from various events that you love and cherish, the songs, all those sort of things that go along with it. It's important on a regular basis to back up. And if you're not the type of person who remembers to do it all the time, or you're very, very busy like Gary Baker, get an online service where you back up automatically in the background on a regular basis. It's worth the few bucks you pay for.
Yep.
You know, and I, instead of just a service, I automatically back up to OneDrive, which is in the cloud. I don't store anything on my computer, because as soon as I try to store it on any one computing device, I interoperate between three different devices, and I need to get to things from any of those three devices.
Right. And that's the value of something like OneDrive.
And OneDrive, it's always there, and they back it up. They back it up in three places. I never have to worry about it again once it's back.
And you were, Eddie was complaining a little bit about that.
Oh, I was going, why does the Microsoft OS want me to save to OneDrive? I want to save it to my, you know, existing hard
drive. Yeah, see. And
I'm just a creature of habit.
And you can always use other services. You can use Dropbox. You can use Mosey. Yes, there's tons of them out there.
But OneDrive, it's a gig, and then if you want more, you ask them for more, and they give it to you.
Yeah.
For free?
Yeah. For free. That's so far I've asked, and that's what they've done. So
everything comes with a price.
Well, so, you know, I don't care as long as it's free to me.
Hey, we've got a caller who has some answers, which is kind of nice. Okay. Joe is with us from Livonia. Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Hi, guys.
Very good. You have some answers.
Well, I hope they're answers for Alex in regards to the problems that he's having.
Okay. Well, hey, go back and refresh me on that one. What was the problem with Alex?
Well, he had a whole bunch of them in terms of being able to get online and maybe having to upgrade his operating system to get a better choice of browsers.
Okay.
And if I remember correctly, with Google, you need to have an Intel-based system, and I'm not sure if it's 10.5 or 10.6, which is the bottom line that it will operate with.
And he did have the Intel system. That's what he told us.
Yeah, he had it, and he was running 10.5.
Right.
Yep.
But, Cal, we were saying in the break, Cal, that you might have to go up to 10.6. For some
to
of those
Snow
changes.
Leopard, right?
Snow Leopard.
Right, because he was saying that for $19, that's a no-brainer to upgrade from the next version, and
Leopard
all future upgrades after that are free, right?
Now, we're talking with Apple computers.
With
after,
the Apple computer.
After then upgrade, from then on, they charge nothing.
You so after you go from Lion, then you go to Huntress, and then, you know, Cougar, and then
right,
50
then
Shades
again,
of Grey.
You're also going to have a possible problem in terms of what hardware is he running to start with, as to whether or not he can even go to 10.6.
Well, when he went to the Apple store, they said that he could go to 10.6.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Right. All right. Now, in terms of alternate browsers, first of all, I have found that Firefox that will run on mine, which is 10.5, don't even waste your time with it. Yeah. But there are two others. There's something called OmniWeb. And it's through the www.omnigroup.com/OmniWeb.
OmniWeb, okay.
And it is version 5.11.2 and then version blah, 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 blah. And then there is a second one called SeaMonkey, which I believe they're both Mozilla takeoffs. And SeaMonkey is a version 2.0.14, and I wasn't able to come up to an address for that one.
Okay.
So has that worked well for you? Because I know most of the developers that I know, they don't test for those.
Well, what it is that they're offshoot groups that have upgraded so that they'll be more functional with today's browser requirements.
So they actually report themselves as being a different version of Mozilla, as an example.
I believe they're both Mozilla. But I will warn him in terms of OmniGroup, it seems to me that if you've got a site that is heavily Flash, it doesn't seem to want to work very nicely.
Mm. Yeah,
but with SeaMonkey, I don't seem to be having the same problems.
So there's almost 300 different browsers out there in some form or another. Many have not been kept up to date. And the reason that they haven't, and they haven't been big competitors, is because as developers, we just cannot test against every one of those browsers. So sometimes you'll go to a website, and a lot of websites, as long as it's compatible enough, it'll work. But there'll be some sites that it just won't be compatible, and the developers don't even care because it's such a small fraction of the browser market.
Yeah.
They just can't it's just too long to try to take every change you ever make to your website and test it against
those
browsers.
That's what these are. These are special interest groups, if you will, that are offshoots that, because they are still running 10.5, 10.4, et cetera, they have made it their goal to sit there and try and keep these browsers functional with today's requirements.
You know, it's interesting.
I understand that. It's the website developer that you got to get to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the problem.
What you're saying.
Yeah. That's the problem.
Joe, it's interesting. It's SeaMonkey. I never heard of it. It's a project, and it says here under the hood, SeaMonkey uses much of the same Mozilla source code, which powers such successful siblings as Firefox and Thunderbird.
Right, but Firefox doesn't work with the word diddly, if you will, with 10.5.
I've heard that there's been problems recently with Firefox in particular,
Well, the best thing is, if you're going to play mainstream internet, as I call it, then you have to use a mainstream browser. Mm-hmm. And that means you're going to either be on IE, Safari, or Chrome, or something like that.
As much as we'd like it not to be that way, that's the way it is.
That is the game.
Chrome won't work, like I said, unless he's in 10.6.
Yeah.
And Intel.
Now, did you have another question for us, Joe, by the way?
No, that was just information for Alex.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thanks so much, Joe.
Sure, I'm sending the bill.
I love it.
And actually, we do like for when people can help us out, Joe brought up some good opportunities for us to talk about the different, because there are different browsers out there. Like I said, there's still, many of them are not kept up to date, but there's almost 300 different browsers.
Right, and I've only used 262 of them, so there's at least 44 of them out there I still have to try.
Yeah, but there's, but if you're probably going to go to the big four.
I'm curious, just among us, what browser you normally use?
I use IE at work because we have internal systems that only work with IE.
Internet Explorer.
And then I've been working a lot with Chrome lately, although I have Firefox and I use, on my Apple products, I use Safari.
Ed?
Internet Explorer and Chrome.
Okay.
Cal? I always stick with the manufacturer. If I'm on Apple, it's Safari. If I'm on Windows, I use IE. Yep.
And I'm on an Apple base. I use Chrome quite a bit and then Safari. And I kind of go between them depending on what issues I have. Right. But, yeah, it's interesting. Chrome is something I think we all know about.
I've been using it more and more.
We got the last time for you to give us a call, 800-859-0957. Give us a ring right now. We'll try to help you. Thank you so much for being with us here. And my sincere thanks on this Valentine's Day to Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson for being with me in studio here for, these 3 hours. We got some more folks calling in right now. We'll be with Kurt from Fenton in just a moment. But thank you, folks. By the way, our homepage, internetadvisor.net, is the place that you go for all the information you will hear from this program. On Sunday night, I post the podcast, and we break it down by hour, so you can listen to or download portions of it or listen to the entire podcast during the rest of the week.
He said thank you to you, Ed. Did he give you flowers and candy?
It's a long trip home. Hey, by the way, guys, I asked before about the five top industries to be impacted by drones. And this is according to an article in CNET. From number five, it was journalism. Think of all the things that have been impacted by now the ability to fly over sites and to really get the eyes on.
In that case, can I guess one?
Okay, go ahead.
Real estate?
That would be, yes, part of it.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. And mapping would be number four. And mapping could be real estate. It could be any number of different things. Like they had a construction project that's going on, and you can actually watch at a distance. You could be anywhere in the world and watch that construction site go up.
Well, and we had a company called Lunatic come in that was working, had a contract with Google and the Small Business Association of Michigan, and they were working in Michigan to map not only exterior, but were flying drones in large buildings.
Yeah, it's amazing. Number three was transportation for things. For instance, I didn't know this. The military is using drones now, huge drones. They can carry up to 6,000 pounds, and they're delivering supplies to troops.
Well, we have autonomous vehicles on the horizon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for my autonomous drone. If they can keep my car separated from other cars and not get in an accident, send the drone to pick me up and take me to work.
Send in the clowns? No, send in the drone, yeah. Number two is law enforcement, of course, when there are hostile situations. But what do you think the number one is?
Pizza delivery.
Agriculture for farming. Because you can look down on, let's say, a part of soil to tell the water that's there or on any number of different things.
Would they use the drone for crop dusting?
I would think it would be. Why not, right? That would be the right thing to do.
That'd be great. That sucker just...
Well, but be the a point lot of, better.
The issue
can
is...
Can you imagine that?
Drones are working, and they're doing a lot of heavy lifting right now.
Yeah, but can you imagine not having to do crop dusting? Because you spend a lot of time outside of...
Why not?
Not being over the field. Well, if you could lay down what you need to and not make that big loop to come back again, if you could just stop.
It could put the control into the individual farmer.
Absolutely.
And he could just stand
on the ground.
Standing on the ground, hovering 50 foot above the ground. And
he wouldn't even have to do that. He could just GPS his location of his land right there, hit the button, thing
and
goes
automatically,
up and drops it.
Yep, honey, let's go out to dinner. And while we're gone, the drone's going to fertilize our garden.
Oh, I love it. It's fascinating. Okay, let's get to Kurt from Fenton.
I hadn't thought of it, but that's wonderful.
Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the Internet Advisor. How can we help you?
Thank you for taking my call. This is a call about a home cell phone repeater amplifier network that I purchased from, can I say who it is?
Sure.
It's Wilson Electronics. They sell it yet. So I'm a Verizon Wireless customer. I've hit fringe service since moving to this area in Fenton.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the backside of a hill. It has to do with topography to the nearest Verizon cell site. My question is, how do I find the location of my nearest Verizon Power. Basically, I installed the system, have consulted with their tech support from Wilson, and they've been pretty good. The four-band amplifier repeater I bought has indicator lights that will indicate feedback loops, which cause the amplifier to reduce power output. Had a lot of trouble with the, so I have a inside amplifier repeater connected with LMR 400 coax cable going to an external Yagi antenna pointed to the nearest Verizon site.
Well, that sounds really complicated. Last time I hooked one of these things up, it was a Sprint, but I've done Verizon in the past, and the thing had integrated GPS.
Right.
I plugged it into the router, and I had a phone, and it discovered everything, and within 20 minutes, I had everything set up. But the Sprint was free. The Verizon was not. I think it was $170. I had to pay for that, or the customer paid for that.
No, you don't have to pay for it. You never have to pay for those rascals.
Yes, and Cal went through this. Tell him that story.
What you need to do is you need to call Verizon up and say, look, guys, I'm paying for service for you. I can't get it at my house. I need something to boost that signal to me. I need to know where that tower is and everything, and I want you to send me the equipment to do it. And if they say they're going to charge you, you say no. You need to send it to me for free because you are obligated to do such.
Yep.
I don't think they're obligated, but they want your service.
I've
done the same thing.
I've talked to Verizon 10 times, and it's a known fringe area. It was a real battle.
So they're playing hardball.
Yeah. So eventually I just went out and purchased this equipment. Now I'm having trouble. I think what's happened is that AT&T has installed a nearby tower that is on 800 megahertz, and I'm on 850 with Verizon, and I believe it's causing interference. Do you know anybody who installs these systems where I can get a tech, you know, pay them to come out and troubleshoot my system?
I could tell you what to do in this case.
Okay.
Switch to AT&T.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah,
well, it does make sense. Why would you buy service that can't be delivered to you when you could get service from someone who can deliver it to you?
There's a huge battle right now between AT&T and Verizon. Verizon's just changed their entire price model to match what T-Mobile and what AT&T is doing. You might want to call them and just to see how that would benefit to do free switchover. I mean, unless there's a legitimate reason why you need to stay with Verizon. But if they're not providing, you know, they'll get the message if enough customers leave in the Fenton area.
I went to AT&T. I had the same problem with my wife's phone. My kid's phone worked fine in our house. My wife's phone didn't. She took it back to AT&T a couple times. They gave her new ones. And it still didn't work. So I went back and I said, I need a microcell. And they said, it's going to be $100.
Right.
And I said, I'm going to switch to Verizon. They said, here's your microcell. And they handed it to me. I plugged it in, had the same experience with Ed. It found it, and it was just really easy.
Right. It really easy. So if you got this Wilson one, you might want, I don't know how much you invested, take it back and call them. And I thought it was $170. I was mistaken.
This
about $101. Yeah.
So it might Sprint's free. Time.
And Gary's right. They're not obligated to give it to you. But as a customer, if you're insistent enough and pleasant, you know, you don't have to call them nasty names. But if you're insistent and pleasant, they should give it to you for nothing.
You know, when you think about what I pay per month for
phones. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The $100 was easy. You know, it was an easy decision for them to make.
Not to mention the fact you just say, you know, I'm going to start streaming more movies on a regular basis, so you're going to get more bandwidth, you're going to get more revenue from me, so hey, why can't I get the box?
The bottom line is you are not providing the service to me that you have said, and I've got to go someplace else that I can get that, period. So don't hang on with lousy service, Kurt, or buying all this fancy equipment, it sounds like, is...
I'd take it back like Gary said, and I'd make Verizon give me the equipment I need.
Yep, or switch to AT&T.
Or switch to AT&T. I'm sorry to make it kind of simplistic in that, Ray.
AT&T has been just a little bit farther ahead than Verizon at changing to the new plan.
And T-Mobile would love your business.
I was just going to say that, too.
Well,
Kurt, thank you. Hey, Kurt, we're right at the end of the program. If you want to continue the dialogue, please go to internetadvisor.net and put an email to us through the Contact Us button.
And we'd be happy to
continue. We're happy to continue that conversation. And Don from Ortonville, we're not going to have time to take your call online. But hang on. We're going to put you on hold, and we'll try to talk to you after the program. For the rest of you folks out there, thank you so much for being with us during this extended program. It's been a delight. My name is Foster Brown. Gary Baker, my co-host, along with Ed Rudell and Cal Carson and all the guys behind the glass, we thank you as well. Don't forget, on Sunday night, the podcast will be available to you. Simply go to internetadvisor.net and you'll find our show notes and the breakdown of the program. Or you can go to iTunes and sign up for our podcast delivered to you every week through iTunes. On behalf of all of us here, have a great Valentine's Day and enjoy and stay warm.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisors Show, the longest-running, locally produced computer show in Detroit radio. If you'd like to find out more about our weekly show, ask a question of our experts, or find the show notes for this podcast, visit internetadvisor.net. And you'll also find us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.